We'll be dealing with the myth of feminine weakness. Let me ask, how many people were not here last time? Okay, a few. I'll sort of review a little bit, and then we'll continue and maybe draw some things that were said last time. We started out with Berger and Luckman as two sociologists of religion. And they basically emphasize the culture creates us and we create culture. And next to it, we have sort of something of the animal kingdom. And at one level of the animal kingdom, those that have the most simplest nervous systems, all their behavior is determined by instinct, by genes. Thus, when you have spiders or octopi or salmon, no one, their parents don't have to teach them how to behave. They know automatically. Their genes tell them. They also don't have much adaptability. If the environment changes, their genes will keep telling them to do the old behavior and they will become extinct. As we move toward animals with increasing complexity of the nervous system, we find parenting becoming important, learning how to behave. And when we get to human beings, maybe dolphins, we don't know much about them, but as we get to human beings, we find out that much of our behavior is learned by culture. We are taught how to behave. That's why parents spend, we have such a long childhood. Our childhood is very long compared with the other animals. Childhood is when you learn the best, and our children have to be taught so much more than other people. So as we're raising children, we raise them, we teach them how to behave, how to fit into our culture, so they'll get along. And we know that people in different cultures will have different ways of doing things. How many of you have lived in another country? Anybody? What countries? Japan and Holland. Japan has a little bit of trouble understanding people sometimes, or not?
You mean when we lived there?
Yeah. Sure. The culture is very different, and sometimes people want to be polite and they're rude and they don't understand what different things mean. How about you? Oh, that was pretty different culture or not? You getting some cultural gaps there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Israel and Lebanon.
How did that work out?
Well, I was in a setting where I was with a lot of other Americans, but it was very different.
That's right. Even in America, we sometimes have difficulty communicating between ethnic groups, right? As I said last time, I was raised in a Czech culture. And did anybody ever see the movie The Deer Hunter? Well, there's that wedding scene that was, it's a scene that shows this wedding dance, which is very loud and boisterous. That was kind of interesting when I saw that scene, because that was the first time I had seen it from the outside. I had participated in, we weren't quite that boisterous, but we were pretty close. I mean, we didn't carry the groom on his shoulders, but a lot of that kind of Eastern European wedding dances, chivalries, we called them. And I went to them as a child and as a teenager. And so we're a little louder, a little boisterous, and perhaps more argumentative. When I went east, I was taught in a Catholic school for a while, Augustinian school, and I met other people that were sort of had same kinds of conditioning as I did. Irish, they're pretty loud people. Italians and Eastern Jewish people, you know, and oh yeah, we're all really loud and had a good time. When I moved to Moorhead, Minnesota, okay, you understand that Norwegians have been culturally conditioned to be a little quieter, and I was very surprised that I was sort of found to be loud and almost rude when I didn't mean to be at all. I mean, but, you know, we are formed by our culture, and I don't think it's the Czechs, Irish, Italians have genes for loud, boisterous behavior. Norwegians have genes for more subtle, quieter, gentler behavior, perhaps. It's just the way we're culturally conditioned. And so, as we learn, as we grow up in a culture, we learn to do things. To do things without even thinking, so it becomes second nature, so we can cooperate with one another. We learn to eat food with a fork in America. We learn to sit quietly in sessions like this. We learn to move to the right when we meet somebody on a path. And we don't even think about what we're doing unless we happen to run into an English person. And they also move to the right, and then we bump into one another. We can also, in these culturally conditioning, which is very good because it helps us survive and cooperate with one another and work together, we can also pick up bad things. For instance, racist attitudes. As a child growing up in Wilbur, Nebraska, the only people I knew were Czechs. And I learned everything I knew about Africans from those horrible films. You know the kinds of films that portrayed Africans as savages and white people going in, and the good Africans were those that helped the white people take their land and the bad Africans were those that tried to resist? Well, I didn't mean to be a racist. I think last time I used the example of Native Americans, American Indians, I didn't mean to be a racist. I didn't even realize I was until I became aware of how my culture had taught me some things that just were not true. And the problem with these kind of subtle learnings of racism or sexism is that they influence us and we aren't even aware of how they're influencing us. So if we want to deal with it, we have to become aware. And that's what I'm trying to do in this sessions, or talk about some myths about women that may still influence our behavior, influence the way we perceive things, only we're not aware of it because it's second nature. Now, last time, I did the myth of feminine evil, and I showed how it developed out of the Old Testament, the patriarchal society, where the head of the family was always the man, and then his dependents, wives, women, children, slaves, were to serve the man. Women in the Old Testament are not considered frivolous or silly, but very competent, very smart. That meant that in the Old Testament you have good women, and those are the ones that go along and help the man and serve the patriarchal society and use their many talents to promote the family structure, and bad women, or I guess I should have put down dangerous women, and those were like Delilah, who deceived Samson by using her special talents of persuasion to lead him astray. Then we went through and showed how this developed in the intertestamental period, with special emphasis on Eve as a deceiver of men because she ate the fruit first, and on that watcher story in Genesis 6, 14, or 1, Genesis 6, verses 1 to 4. Saw how in the later Christian tradition this developed, particularly when Christians wanted to reach Christian perfection by not having any sexual drives. The men that did the writing that was reserved were heterosexual men, so women were the temptresses who brought them into, got them sexually aroused, and they thought that was sinful. And so you had developing the notion of a bad woman who is a harlot, or Eve, and the good woman who is a virgin, like Mary, or else a woman obedient to her husband and caring for him in all places. Now, I think we have remnants of that myth today, which continues to influence our behavior and the way we evaluate things. And I think with last time we closed with some examples. In many crimes against women, particularly those involving sexual crimes, we blame the victim, or our society tends to do this. Sexual harassment, she asked for it. She was being an Eve, she was being a temptress. My jeans are too tight or something. Or maybe, as one person pointed out, she just happens to be a pretty woman, and then she's being an Eve or a temptress. Rape, she asked for it. Haven't you ever heard that? Many of our laws on terms of rape are very difficult in terms of really causing horrible hassle for the victim. You know, and some states now are becoming more sensitive in trying to change the laws, saying that a woman's past sexual activity cannot be introduced as evidence unless it is really relevant. You know, and there would be in the past, it would the common way to defend a person against rape would be to get a woman, the victim, on the stand and ask her about any sexual relationship she may have had, implying that if she wasn't a virgin, then she was a harlot, an Eve, who deserved to be raped. We see this on the impact on rape on its victims. The guilt and humiliation that many people experience, that all people experience when they are raped. And by the way, the same guilt and experience and humiliation is experienced by men who have been raped homosexually. You know, it's the same kind of pattern. And I was, and I use an example, a woman who had been raped, who I had to deal with, who was one of my students. And what I didn't tell you was this is the second time she had been raped. She had also been raped as a 13 or 14 year old girl, alone in waiting for a bus in the bus station or her uncle's to pick her up. And two men, strangers, came, raped her, beat her up, and killed her dog who was with her. She never told her parents. They were Orthodox Jews, and she was felt too guilty to tell her parents. And when she came to me after the second incident, what she kept telling me, or asking me very impassionately, is, am I a bad person? She had just been victimized, but am I a bad person? I don't think I'll ever forget that conversation for as long as I live. A notion of a mysterious power theory that a woman turns a man on and he can't control himself, which I think is very degrading to men. You know, that's not the men I know. And it was even embodied as late as 20 years ago in Texas law. In Texas law, as of at least 20 years ago, and 17, and I think it's now been changed, but only within the last 17 years. If a husband caught his wife and another man in bed with another man, he could kill both the wife and the lover, and it would be called justifiable homicide. Or if he had good reason to think they were lovers and he went and shot him, it would be justifiable homicide. Texas, the great state of Texas. Needless to say, if a woman caught her husband and his lover in bed and she killed him, it was not justifiable homicide. We get this in the sense of a woman's fault, and we see this internalized in victims of spouse abuse, women who have been beaten by their husbands often feel it's their fault. We see this in the double standard we have in sexual ethics. Boys will be boys, but girls must be pure, where women have to take all responsibility for controlling sexual ethics and sexual activity. And if she says yes, even among my Denison students who are, where sex I think becomes trivialized, you have, she's classified as a bad woman. And therefore, she's a harlot. You can do anything with her that you want. So I think this myth continues with us today, even though we're not doing things like burning witches. It continues to influence us. Now, I want to make a transition then from the myth of feminine weakness, or from the myth of feminine evil to the myth of feminine weakness. And I think I have a way to do that. These are all interrelated. And I'd like you to do some free association for me. And I'm going to ask you to do stereotyping, just your immediate impression in terms of stereotyping. Now, I remember I was just at a conference on how to teach writing before I came here, and somebody gave us an assignment that caused us to stereotype and then criticize us for stereotyping. Well, I'm not going to do that. I called that was unfair because the assignment was making us we were manipulated into stereotyping, therefore we shouldn't be criticized for it. But we have those two images of women, Mary and Eve, and I just wonder, the first impression that comes to the top of your head, and I'm going to take a vote and see if I can get any kind of consensus very quickly, whether this attribute would be associated with Mary or with Eve. Okay, one or the other, and here's your voting, and it'll be easy to remember. And I just want to get a quick raise of hands, and if there's a consensus, I'll write it down, and if there's not a consensus, I won't. Just see if there's, you know, attributes we associate. And so people up there in the balcony, you know, can vote too. Now, for Mary, if it's an attribute you associate with Mary, just raise your hand like this, kind of a nice, gentle hand. If it's Eve, raise your hand like this, a fist. And if you don't associate it with either Mary or Eve, just kind of raise your hand, you know, sort of, you know, saying, I don't think that's appropriate. And we'll see if we get any consensus, okay? Mary's a nice hand, Eve's a fist, and Thumbs down, that's how to do it. I don't think it applies to either, okay? How about humble? Okay, humble we get from Mary, all right? Now, you might get outvoted, but, you know, so I'm just trying to get a general impression. Gentle. Okay, Mary. Crafty. Crafty. Okay, we get E there. Nurturing. Mary. Clever. Eve. Bold. B-O-L-D. Eve. Obedient. Mary. Strong. Well, let's see, we're getting a mixture on that.
Sweet, can you use both hands?
Okay, I guess we leave that one off. I think there's kind of a mixture. Emotional. I think that's a thumbs down. That's kind of, you know, I'm not getting any clear sense. Quiet. Mary. Assertive. Eve. Kind. Mary. Daring. Eve. How about competent? Okay, knock that one. Independent. Weak. Thumbs down. Okay. Now, so for around Mary, we got quiet, humble, gentle, nurturing, obedient, kind. Around Eve, bold, clever, crafty, assertive, daring, and independent. Okay, who needs the protection of the man, Mary or Eve, from what we put up there?
Mary.
Mary, I think so. And that's the myth of feminine weakness. The myth of feminine weakness is that women are weaker in at least certain aspects, certainly not in nurturing. You know, they're strong in that, right? In gentleness and kindness, in those kinds of attributes we traditionally associate with caring and parenting. You know, they're really strong there, but they need the protection of a man. Now, as I grow up and in the church, the person that needs protection more is Mary. You know, Eve can sort of take care of herself. And Christianity, yes?
We only have one brief instance. With Mary, we hear a lot more about her and being the chosen mother of God. You know, I find it really difficult to go ahead and say.
Yes, well, this is, we're going really by the stereotypes that has developed in the church, the way it's portrayed, say, in the post-biblical material. In fact, I don't know if I'll get to do it while I'm at Holden, but I have a talk that would say, if you look at the biblical Mary, she's a very independent woman who makes her own decisions, who, when the angel comes, she doesn't say, hey, I better consult Joseph, you know, but she says, hey, that's fine, I'll do it, and becomes a theologian in the Magnificat. And so I don't think this is a biblical Mary. And so I want to make that clear. I'm really trying to deal with how it has developed in popular Christian piety. Because I don't think that's a biblical Mary at all. But I think that's how it has developed throughout the ages. But this is the piety that as a child I grew up with. And I was supposed to be like Mary, right? Not like Eve. In other words, I should be nurturing, kind, and loving, but also dependent upon men. Now, let's go back to, and I'm going to review a little bit what I said last time. In the Old Testament culture, women were highly dependent upon men, right? They got their definition in terms of men. They were the wives of, the daughters of, the mothers of. And that put women in a very precarious situation when they didn't have a male protector. They would have to get married, and then if they would die without any male heirs to take care of them, they wouldn't inherit their property, but they would become no place for them. And that's why in the Old Testament, when you have lists, the outcasts, be kind to the poor, the strangers, the orphans, and the widows. They're always in a precarious situation. So this very dependence upon men puts women in a terribly precarious situation in the Old Testament. Today it does the same thing. I have a hard time sometimes understanding women who stay with husbands that abuse them. You know, and it seems to me that I would leave. But I'm not dependent upon men. I'm not married. I support myself the way many of these women are. And they feel very dependent upon men. Very dependent upon men. Usually that's why they stay. For the support of themselves, for the support of their children. They're worried that men will come after them and find them and kill them. And there's some danger of that. And so this dependency may be causing a problem today. And that's what the myth of feminine weakness is, that women cannot take care of themselves, that there are certain things they cannot do, and they need a man. Now, I can imagine some people saying, hey, wait a minute, whoa. Isn't Christianity based on love? And doesn't love mean being dependent upon one another? I love my parents. I am dependent upon them in some ways, not like I was when I was a child. My mother loves me. She's dependent upon me. That's right, and here's what I would like to talk about in terms of love as mutuality, not domination, subordination, a mutual dependence. And I think Paul Tillich does a very good job of defining love as the reunion of the separated. The coming together of two subjects so that the individuality of each person is preserved. So that the individuality and subjectivity of each person is preserved.
Could you say that again?
The reunion of the separated, and the reunion comes in because of the fall, you know, we were meant to be together. Mm-hmm. The coming together of two subjects so that the individuality of each is preserved. Now let me give you an example of something that would not be love. Let us say I meet a man and he loves me. So he totally does everything I want him to do and conforms his interests to me. He becomes a reflection of me because he wants me. Therefore, he quits fishing, something I don't like, and takes up horseback riding. He gives up his job so he can move in with me. We're going to get married, of course, and take care of my house. He stops being a Republican and becomes a Democrat. He stops being an atheist and becomes a Christian. And he stops watching football on TV and instead watches documentaries. Well, I think what you'd say is I didn't get myself a husband or a lover, but a well-trained puppy doggy. I have reduced him. It's not love, because he has been reduced. Now, it's the same thing if it's reversed, right? If I meet a man and he totally sweeps himself, me, off my feet, and so I immediately start fishing and give up horseback riding, I give up my job, I stop being a Democrat and become a Republican. I give up Christianity and become an atheist, and I watch football on television 20 hours a week. Ugh. Can you imagine anything worse than that? Now, that's not love, because then I would be the puppy doggy. A student, when hearing this, said, but doesn't that mean I should give my all to my man? And I said, sure, if he gives his all to you. A mutual dependency where the subjectivity of each person is respected. There's a mutuality in love. And that's the interdependence or the interrelation that Christians are talking about when they talk about love. A slave cannot have a love relationship with his master as long as there is this domination subordination. Now, in so certain ways then, if women are totally dependent upon men and there's not this kind of equality of subjects, we are less than love. Now, patriarchy, the notion of the male-dominated family structure, was pretty much accepted in the Old Testament. There are some challenges to it, but these are few and far in between. I'll just mention a few places where it gets challenged. These are primarily gifts from God. The Old Testament recognizes prophecy as a charismatic gift from God, and God can give it to whomever God wills, including women. You know, you can't say God's going to give it only to men. Men and women with a valid prophetic ministry message from God must be sought out, heeded, and accorded recognition. The Old Testament specifically mentions several women prophets: Deborah, Miriam, Huldah, and probably Noadiah. Thus, Israel recognized that God could and did communicate with women, even entrusting to them messages of crucial importance for the entire community. And so in that way, they were individuals in their own right and not merely dependent upon. There are several references in the Old Testament also to wise women. And wisdom is a gift God gives to whoever God gives, and whoever has it must be sought out and respected. Finally, there are sorcerers in the Old Testament, and that was also a gift, or not a gift, but it was something people had, and men and women that had it were treated equally. They were all banned. So be they men or women, they got equal treatment there. Now, in the intertestamental period, there were two justifications for women subordination to men, or women dependence upon men. Remember, it was in the intertestamental period that the Eve story came into dominance and the Watcher story in Genesis 6, 1-4. And the first one we dealt with last time, the fact that Eve had first eaten from the forbidden fruit and that women enticed the Watchers, proved that women were morally weak temptresses who were responsible for man's sin. Therefore, the more moral men ought to dominate them. And that's the myth of feminine evil that we dealt with last time. The second was the creation account, where Eve was derived from Adam and thus considered his inferior. We haven't dealt with that one. I'd like to talk a little bit about that today. Now, in the Genesis, we have two creation accounts from two different periods. Now, often the second one has been read as an elaboration of the first, but that's not really the case. They're two independent from different ones. In fact, the first account, the one in Genesis 1, was written last. It's the priestly account. You can tell it's by priests, right? That's the one, and God created, bloom, and then there was, and that was good, right? And God said, let there be, and there was, and it was good. It almost sounds like a liturgy, right? The priest might come up with. So it's easy to remember. And that was probably written between 550 and 450 BC, rather late. Now, in that account, as God starts, he starts creating a lot of things. God creates light, the firmament to divide the nations, the waters, the stars, sun, moon, animals, and finally, humanity. Now, humanity's created last. Does that mean humanity's inferior in that story? No, it's the crowning glory of creation. That's a ring of composition that's found in Hebrew literature. It's the conclusion. You know, it doesn't certainly mean inferiority. Now, also we have a little trouble with terms because of English. Now, some of you speak German, and you know that Mensch is used to mean humanity, right? And then, if you want to speak about men, you can speak about der Mann, or about women, Frau. In English, it used to be man was supposed to be the generic thing that meant everybody, and then you divide it up into man and women. Now, to make it clearer, people are moving to use humanity divided into man and women. That's why you have trouble in translating things. The English word like is very hard to translate in many languages. They don't have a word equivalent to our like. Well, in Hebrew, Adam is a generic term like mensch. And it gets broken up into ish, which means male, and isha, which means female. So we have a division there. And so in the Genesis 1:27, the correct reading of it would be, so God created Adam in his own image, male and female, he created them. Adam meaning the generic term. And so if you would read that passage, it would really be by our New English translation, so God created humanity in his own image, male and female, he created them. So the Genesis account is the first account, seems to reinforce men and women as both in the image of God. The second account, the Adam and Eve story, was written earlier. That's called the J account because he uses the word Yahweh for God. And so it's called the J account. It's the one, you kind of think it's earlier, don't you? It's sort of the nice kind of storytelling thing, you know, about God walking in the garden and talking to Adam and Eve. And that's written probably between 900 and 800 B.C. We don't know who wrote it. It's called the J account, and he's really a great storyteller, right? He's a storyteller. He's not like the priests who are interested in liturgy. Now, the order of this account is quite different. The heavens and earth are created first, then Adam, second, then Eden, the garden, then the plants and the animals, and finally Eve. Now, there are two interpretations of the account I would like to give you. One is Phyllis Tribbles, who's a biblical professor at Union, and John Tavard, who's a Catholic biblical scholar. Now, they say that when God created Adam first, Adam means humanity. And so the creation of Eve later was the separation of humanity into Isha. And those are the words that are used. It goes from humanity into male, female. And so they would say it's not Eve, women were not created last. You know, but the humanity was separated into male and female. And that would make sense in the sense that the command not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is given to Adam, but Eve knows about it. You know, so that was before a division. Phyllis Bird, another biblical scholar, disagrees, but she would say that Adam, in this instance, the first Adam, really has connotations of masculinity. You know, it's, when you have these words, you always have to argue whether they really mean the generic or the masculinity. But she sees Eve then in the ring as a ring of composition. You know, as complementary and not inferior any more than humanity was inferior in the first creation account. So modern biblical scholars will certainly argue that it is incorrect to say that the woman was created second and therefore is inferior as they look at back at the Hebrew text. Another way that this account has been shown that women should be subordinate to men was a helpmate thing. And let me quote the verse, and this is from the RSVP, 2:18. It is not good that Adam should be alone. I will create a helper fit for him. Well, helper means subservient, right? Well, not always. That same word in the Hebrew text is used in other Hebrew passages. Sometimes it means a helper is inferior, subordinate. Sometimes a helper is equal. And sometimes God, the same word is used, is described as Israel's helper. So you certainly cannot, from the word helper, come up with conclusive evidence that that means inferior. Now, so in the biblical, you know, at least in these creation accounts that are quoted throughout much of Christianity as justifying women's inferiority or weakness, are really not, at least in the creation accounts, you really do not find that and can do, justify it. However, the themes of women as morally or mentally or physically inferior keep reappearing. And as it's usually done, it's done in terms of women are good at some things, the things that Mary is good at, nurturing, caring, but she's not very good at other things. And this can become, you've all heard of a self-fulfilling prophecy, haven't you? Mm-hmm. You know, you think something's going to happen and then it happens. And blaming the victim. And let's talk a little bit about victim blaming, because I mentioned it in terms of rape, but this is a common means in terms of used to reinforce discrimination against any group of people. And so my first example would be from racism. In the United States, in the southern states, many of those states that had slaves were not allowed to teach black people to read. It was against the law. Thus, a person that will be appearing later, let me tell you about Sarah Grimke. Did you ever hear of Sarah Grimke? She was an early abolitionist who was raised in a plantation. She was one of the slave owners. And as a little girl, she had some trouble with slavery. And she was taught to teach Sunday school to the black children at the age of 8 or something. And she wanted to teach them the way she had learned, namely, show them in the book and read the book to them. And she was told she couldn't do that because she couldn't teach us slaves to read. And so she, sort of in spite, I guess, she was always sort of a little bit of an impetuous person, taught her slave how to read, who was her, the girl, the black girl that was taking care of her, who was her same age. Her father found out about it and told her that she could, I think it was go to jail or be fined $20,000, I don't know, enormous amount of money. And that was against the law. So blacks could not be taught to read. Some of them learned on their own, or some people taught them. So we prevented blacks from learning to read, and then people criticized them for not having the intellectual gifts of white. See, that's blaming the victim. How many of you have seen the film Last Cave at Dimbaza? Have any of you on South Africa? Powerful film, huh? Well, one scene is talking about apartheid in South Africa, and I was really disturbed to hear this. One of my students at Denison, they didn't say this loud enough so I could hear. But one of the jobs that blacks could get in the city, as Johannesburg, is to help with the garbage. Do you people remember that garbage? Yeah, it's a powerful scene, right? You're not going to forget it. And in the garbage thing, the white truck driver would drive the garbage truck at a slow speed, but never stop it. Meanwhile, the blacks had to run, pick up the garbage, run after the truck, carrying it on their heads, dump it in there, return the garbage pail, and run to the next. So they were running constantly, carrying garbage pails, dumping them, and running back. They were earning with that hard work all day of running after garbage trucks with empty and full, you know, things of garbage. You would imagine that they'd make a lot of money, but they were being paid below the poverty line, even if they worked full time, you know, on that job. Well, they looked sort of silly. You know, I mean, it does. You know, you see these people running, and my reaction was, oh, how horrible! The people are doing this to other people. And I guess some students were saying, oh, look at those dumb niggers. They don't know what they want. Laughing at them. So the whites were forcing them to do this, you know, cruddy labor, and then laughing at them. That's called victim blaming, okay? You know, where you force people to do something and then criticize them for not doing it. Now, the same thing happened to women in earlier cultures. And this is seen in the 19th century. Let me give you some examples. These are non-religious examples, but it's easier to see things in earlier cultures than it is in our own. And that's why I use so many historical examples. In the 19th century, it was considered that women were so weak mentally, good at these things, nurturing, you know, taking care of the family, that if you tried to educate them, they couldn't take it. You know, their poor minds would collapse. They would be a nervous wreck if you tried to educate them. And let me just read you one example. And this was a clergyman educator. And if I use the word clergyman, I mean man, right? I'm going to use inclusive language. If I mean clergy people, or I'll use that. So this is what a clergyman declared in 1830. As for the training of young ladies through a long intellectual course, as we do young men, it can never be done. They will die in the process. Enforcing the intellect of women beyond what her physical organization can bear. In these years, the poor thing has on her brain, crowded with history and grammar, arithmetic, geography, natural history, chemistry, physiology, physics, astronomy, rhetoric, natural and moral philosophy, metaphysics, French, often German, Latin, perhaps Greek, reading, spelling, committing poetry, writing compositions, drawing, painting, etc., etc. Then out of school, from 3 to 6 hours of severe toil at the piano, she must be on the strain of the school hours, study in the evening till her eyes ache. Her brain whirls, her spine yields and gives way, and she comes through the process of education feeble, without courage or vigor. If you want to know why I lack courage or vigor, that's it. Alas, must we crowd education upon our daughters, and for the sake of making them intellectual, make them pruny, nervous, and their whole earthly existence a struggle between life and death. Now that's, again, it's a pretty, that's the kind of thing that was being said in the 19th century. Now, I went through PhD comps,
You know, I almost ended up pruny. I certainly ended up nervous. And I didn't get an ulcer. But I must say that I seem to stand the strain as well as the men. You know, we got zany together and got through it. Well, we have great zany stories. I mean, if you ever want some good stories, when you get into something where you're studying 18 hours a day, you know, and then you get together and, oh, we had fun. But I got through it, you know, and I have not yet collapsed into a nervous breakdown, or do I feel that my whole earthly existence is a struggle between life and death. Now, notice what happens. To protect women, we keep them dependent upon men and inferior because they're so weak. Notice the same thing happened in slavery. I can, you know, quote passage after passage, some from medical journals. Medical journals said, blame this, that the reason for black ill health, which they overestimated, in the after the slavery period when they were freed, was because blacks couldn't cope with the complexities of white culture. Now, the fact that blacks might have had some physical difficulties might have something to do with the fact they were in poverty, right? But they didn't. And a medical journal said, if we wouldn't have freed them, you know, they would have been better. They needed the white person's protection. They needed the slave owner's protection. Now, in the late 1800s and early into this century, French scientists were big on measuring brain sizes. So it shows that how science itself, you know, objective science, can reinforce myths of inferiority. And they were big on measuring brain sizes. And what they would do is do autopsies on people and weigh brains. And their data is, now this is really big stuff. You know, I mean, this was a big movement. And what they would weigh them very carefully, and their data was very good. Now, they might not have taken certain factors into account. For instance, but what they found out was that the woman's brain size is smaller than a man's. Now, some of this is that a woman's brain size will be, or anybody's brain size might be correlated with height, and so men might be taller than women. It's not correlated with weight because you know, you don't have any fat on the brain, so it might be on height. It also is, as we get older, our brain weight decreases, and they had done autopsies, and if we have a serious illness, our brain size weight will decrease. And so they were comparing the brains of very old women who had died from severe illnesses with young men who had been killed not automobile accidents, but in accidents. Well, they got some diversity. And they jumped to some conclusions. Now, we don't have any evidence the brain weight is at all correlated with intelligence. That didn't bother them. Gustave Le Bon, who was one of the leading psychologists in France at this time, published the following paragraph, and I'm reading from a scientific journal. In fact, the leading scientific anthropological journal in France in 1879. This is the leading French anthropological journal, a scientific journal, you know, the kind that they have listed in the libraries. That, you know, this is a direct quote translated. In the most intelligent races, as among the Frenchmen, there are a number of women whose brains are closer in size to those of gorillas than to the most developed male brains. This inferiority is so obvious that no one can contest it for a moment. Only its degree is worth discussion. All psychologists who have studied the intelligence of women, as well as poets and novelists, recognize today that they represent the most inferior forms of human evolution and that they are closer to children and savages than to adult civilized man. They excel in fickleness, absence of thought and logic, and incapacity to reason. Without doubt, there exists some distinguished women, very superior to the average man. But they are as exceptional as the birth of any monstrosity. As, for example, of a gorilla with two heads. Consequently, we may neglect them entirely. Now, yeah, I first read that, I fell over laughing. And it is funny in a way. But imagine what that did to all the bright women who read it, or that kind of culture that would accept that as good science. best to act stupid, right? How many of you learned the advice that I learned as a child growing up and when I first started dating guys, and that's always make them think that they brighter than you are? Mm-hmm. How many learned that? Yeah, you know, sort of.
Always listen to them and, you know, believe that they're interesting. Always be interested in what they have to say.
Yeah. That's really sort of a rotten view of men, isn't it? A degrading view of men, that men need to have their egos massaged. You know, I mean, that's really, you know, these myths are very nasty, say very nasty things, not only about women, but also about men. Okay, best to act dumb. In fact, that kind of thing, you know, made it much harder for a woman who was talented to gain any recognition. George Sands, a man or a woman? Woman. Why did she publish under a male name? Because that's the only way she could get her work published. And we have several other novelists. Can anybody name any others that did that? There were several that did that at that time, other than George Eliot, another woman. Right. You couldn't publish under a woman's name. It wouldn't be read. Now, this is a myth of woman inferiority fostered by science. How about psychology? Did you ever hear of Sigmund Freud? Good old Freud. You are looking, according to Freud's analysis, at a very sick woman. Because I have chosen, both in my undergraduate career, chemistry and zoology, and in my graduate career, theological education, a male role, right? And that meant I was mentally ill. It was. Did anybody know what the name of the illness was? Penis envy. Yeah, that's what it is. The theory was that little girls, as they grew up, saw little boys and envied them because they lacked their penis. And it doesn't make sense to me. It made sense to Freud. And therefore, they wanted to be manlike, and so they refused to conform to standard roles. And this was a mental illness that, you know, we could work out of. So that meant that you're sick if you didn't want to do it. Now, that's a horrible way of enforcing behavior, right? Saying that you're ill, if you want to be different, that you're crazy. We can see that in terms of, somebody mentioned it last time, in terms of sex. In Victorian England, if I enjoyed sex, I was considered sick, right? You know,
or
so
at least a bad person.
Or a bad person, right. Or perhaps even mentally ill. There was some of it, Sarah Grimke, one of the things was that if a woman was promiscuous in sex, she would end up crazy. And Sarah asked, being anti-slave, how come that only applied to white women and not to the black women that were raped by the white men? You know, but that was... Well, Willard Galen writes an interesting article. Now, he's a psychoanalyst who's president of the Hastings Institute that deals in biomedical ethics. And he says he has to spend his time reassuring women that they're not sick if they want to say no occasionally. You know, how our society... You've heard that line, haven't you? What's the matter? You hung up about sex? Are you sick? You know, and that's a very powerful way.
Who was that?
Willard Galen, a psychoanalyst. It says a standard line nowadays. What's the matter? You hung up, you know, as if you don't want to sleep with me, therefore you must be crazy or something. And, you know, he actually has to spend time. You know, he was contrasting Victorian time with now, saying that, you know, telling women, yeah, it's okay, you're not mentally ill if you don't want to sleep with every man that asks you. Yeah, right. Yeah, you can have headaches. Yeah, it's okay to say, I got a headache. Now, these are extreme examples. I don't think most of you consider me mentally ill because I, by Freud, because I chose roles that have been traditionally reserved for men. But today, how many of these so-called differences between men and women reinforce the myth of female weakness? Who's better at math? Okay, a lot of this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, there are some studies that suggest, but they're very weird. They're doing a lot of studies called androgyny studies in psychology nowadays, where they're trying to see if there are differences in the thinking processes of men and women. And a lot of differences that people thought did exist, they're finding out didn't. Some people suggest there might be some differences that would arise at puberty. Perhaps. It's all a theory. No one knows for certain. And this would only be statistically significant. You know, not apply to any individual, that perhaps the hormones that are released at puberty will cause the different lobes of the brain to develop a little differently. So perhaps some people say more women are better at language and more men are better at math. Now, I haven't found any conclusive evidence because by the time they get to puberty, already they've been socialized a great deal. A socialization starts by the time it gets a baby, right? Mary, my niece, we all held her very nicely and quietly. Mikey came along and we yelled at him. We went, "Ew!" And Mikey yelled back. And then my sister-in-law thinks they're not sex stereotyping their kids. Wow. Well, notice how, though, we might, with women, in terms of academic achievement, in very subtle ways, buy this myth that there are things they can't do and not encourage them to do it. I'm a hard advisor for women students because I encourage them to take math. Because I tell them there's a big problem if you can't, you know, if you want to go into government or something, there's all these tests and you have to work. You know, you have to be able to do it. And you know, my male colleagues up in high school, you know, you talk to the girls what happened in high school. Well, you don't want to take that. Why don't you take Latin? You don't want to take calculus, right? Or students often say, "I don't want to take calculus." And with the men, they encourage them. And with the women, okay, why don't you take baby bio instead? You know, and I'm a really hard advisor in that way with my women students, and it's that kind of a self-perpetuating prophecy that women lack confidence in themselves. Have you heard of math anxiety? People that get really anxious around math. Oh, you have it? Well, certainly this doesn't apply to all women who have math anxiety. But studies have shown that a certain percentage of them have math anxiety because they're afraid if they succeed, they will be unfeminine. If you succeed, you're not going to be feminine. Notice how that reinforces the myth of feminine weakness. You're feminine if you're like Mary, not if you're assertive. Assertive is a good word for me, by the way. Independence is a good word for me. Daring is too. Clever is a good word for me. So we get into statistical, so we get into real problems today, even physical weakness. Now, I think on this case, I happen to think that men are naturally stronger than women. I think women have, when you measure the ratio of muscle to fat, it's more muscle in men than fat. Now, if we get an Olympic athlete woman, her fat muscle ratio will probably be much more more muscle to fat than any man here. But then if we compare her to men Olympic athletes, you know, then they fall behind. I think there are some differences, but our whole culture has caused us to exaggerate these differences. And when I was a little kid, I was very good in sports. I grew up I was a tomboy. And I grew up in a neighborhood of boys, and my mom thought that was fine. In fact, our biggest argument still is, did she make me quit playing tackle football? I was a fullback of the neighborhood team when I was in the fourth grade, as I claim, or the sixth grade, as she claims. I think it was the fourth grade. She thinks it's the sixth grade. But Nancy Shaw got to play to the eighth grade. And in certain sports, and I was good, you know, compared with the neighborhood kids. And even now, if we ever get a softball game up, like, I don't know why they don't play softball here. I brought my glove. Anybody have a glove? Let's play catch. And, you know, if I get up and I swing a bat, I'll swing it very competently. I'll swing it like a boy. Now, I might not hit the ball because I haven't played softball in a long time. I might strike out and I might hit a bad fly, but I'll swing my bat well. I'll also run like a boy and throw a ball like a boy. Well, when I grew up, running like a girl meant running very inefficiently. You know, kicking your heels out. Throwing a ball meant going like this. And so it was, to be feminine meant you had to be inefficient in sports.
Not assertive or aggressive.
Yeah, and just incompetent. I mean, if you're going to run, take walking. How does a lady walk? Nice small steps, right?
In high heels.
Yeah, in high heels. We're going to get to dress in a minute. Well, if you're hiking, folks, are you going to take nice small steps? That's a very inefficient way of walking, isn't it? Huh? Keeps you weak, right? If you're going to hike, you're going to start taking long. You're going to walk, quote, what I mean is like a man, right? In strength. Now, I'm not a very good athlete anymore. Because from the time I was in junior high till at the age of 28 when I took up racquetball, I didn't do anything. I was discouraged from doing anything other than some standard PE courses along the way. And now I really regret that. You know, I'm out of shape and I'm trying to hike and get back into shape and I do my horseback riding and I'm the klutz of the class and I play racquetball and I gotten fairly good in that, but I stand flat-footed because I'm not used to jumping on my toes. And I think one of the nice changes that's happening is that women nowadays in high school and college are getting much more encouragement to keep themselves physically strong. And we feel better about ourselves when we're physically strong, right?
But in elementary school, you still have a problem if you have daughters, having them find anyone else who wants to do sports like they like sports.
Because
their,
what?
Their friends don't do it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because that they're home, they aren't encouraging them or what, but they still can't find other people who want to play basketball, tennis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my problem in high school, and that's why I dropped out, because I could strike out anybody by throwing them fast at the knees. Mm-hmm. They would never swing.
Well, I think, too, though, on the other hand, there's more programs coming involved where they're starting, like, soccer programs for girls lower age and that kind of thing. I teach physical education, and my husband and I both coach, but my daughter does physical things up to a point, and after that, she's not interested. She's interested mm-hmm. on the playground, playing house, or doing other things. She always mm-hmm. puts her shorts on under her dress, so if she mm-hmm. wants to get physical out there and climb the monkey bars and stuff, she can, but she just chooses not to do that. I think more and more programs are being developed.
I know it's a difference in college now, that at least in the smaller college where I've been teaching, particularly at Concordia College, where you had a lot of women students coming from rural areas, and even in Denison now, there's more of an emphasis on women's sports, more women jogging, more women swimming, more women doing things. And that's, again, maybe, you know, I don't think we're going to get as strong as men, but we're going to get pretty a lot stronger, you know, because our society has encouraged us to be physically weak. And notice, and because we're physically weak, they could protect us from all the good-paying jobs, right? Because they demanded too much strength that we didn't have, so we got protected again. Notice the whole thing of protection is a means of feminine weakness. You know, if we're weak, we have to be protected. One of the things, for instance, that women can do is drive these big machines, you know, construction machines, and it's high-paying jobs. And when they were trying to get women off of welfare in Texas, one of the things they did was to have to train women to do, you know, if they had a lot of kids, they had to give them a good paying job, right? And that would mean running these bulldozers, and they were very good at it, and it got them off welfare. If you put these women on jobs where they're getting not any pay, they can't support their family, so, you know, or pay child care. Of course, somebody already mentioned dress, right? You mentioned dress. I feel much stronger here as I'm dressed in my tennis shoes and jeans, and I feel very, very weak when I'm in high heels, a narrow skirt. I mean, I just feel weak, right? Now, we have to be very careful. Now, so much of what promotes the myth of feminine weakness is protection and also courtesy. And let me give you one example. I wish I had the speech with me, and I wish I can't. First of all, this notion of feminine weakness has always been something for the middle class women. Black slaves were not considered weak, right? My grandmother, who was a homesteader, do you think she was weak? No, your ancestors, you know, these women were strong, right? They worked like a man, right? And once, it was a vote to give women the vote, a meeting to give women the vote. And one of the people that was, a bunch of white clergymen were there, and they were speaking about, one man got up and said, we can't give women the vote. I mean, look how weak they are. We have to even help them in and out of carriages. Look how weak they are. A great big black woman stood up. Her name is Sojourner Truth, and I wish I had her speech, but I'll summarize part of it. And she said, to this man.
Could you spell that name?
Sojourner Truth, T-R-U-T-H, Sojourner Truth. And she got angry and she got up. And she's an ex-slave and she said, no one ever helped me in and out of the carriage. Ain't I a woman? I worked in the fields as much as any man and I would have worked harder if you had fed me enough. Ain't I a woman? I bore 13 kids, and I sold them into slavery, and I cried as mothers do. No man helped me, only Jesus heard me. Ain't I a woman? A very powerful speech, which shows that this myth of feminine weakness has been a, quote, luxury of the middle class. So where do we go from here? Well, I think the myth of feminine weakness has to be challenged. It, if we want, in terms of redemption, to have mutuality and love, we can only do it if all Christians take their responsibility for living in love. John said it well. Christ came to bring light into the world, and that light was love. Christ brought love into the world so we could love God and love one another. 1 John 3:16, 18. By this we know love, that Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But if anyone has the world's keys, goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, love in word, not in word and speech, but in deed and in truth. That's a big challenge, causing all of us to work and to develop our talents so we can contribute. Now, the myth of feminine weakness prevents women from having opportunities. Sarah Krimke, the woman I told you about with the, who taught the slave girl, was okay as long as she was speaking out against slavery to audiences that were women. When she started speaking out to women, all the white clergy in New England, Congregationalists, condemned her. She was not able to do what I think all of us would see as a legitimate Christian task, trying to free slaves, because of this myth. But also, women can use this myth as a means of not accepting our own responsibility and allowing ourselves to become childish and dependent upon others. So it's up to us, to the women here, and to the men, to foster the growth of all of us so we can live in Christ. There's no double standard in Christ. You know, there's no a standard for sexual ethics for men and a standard of sexual ethics for women. All are created in Christ to love and build up their brother and sister. That's why I think this myth has to be challenged, and I think we have to be very aware of how it can influence all aspects of our behavior. Now, I went too long, but let's see if anybody has any comments they'd like to make. Yes?
One comment about, I think it's been found that women usually suffer from depression more than men do. And one of the causes that I have found is that it's because they've been made to feel dependent and weak and conditioned through their lives. And so it's
Yeah, one of the big causes of ulcers or dependency or depression is when you feel you're not controlling your own destiny. Mm-hmm. And you get that same thing in terms of a certain men in jobs who will feel that, they're going to... depression is big in academia now because we're cutting back on the number of professors. You know, you feel, there's nothing I can do. And yes, and I think that's a very good comment. One of my friends was suffering that. She finally ended up getting a divorce, and now she's out working for Lutheran Social Work, Social Service, getting helping refugees become settled, and very effectively. Mm-hmm. And she couldn't when she felt so dependent and trapped. Any other comments?
Last year in January, our school was really pushed into Title IX. We had been doing several things in physical education that were co-ed. But to that time, not everything was co-educational. And one mother got real upset that that wasn't happening, so threatened to sue the school district if that didn't become a gospel, so to speak. And I've always been one that has really enjoyed doing my exercises to music. And I stress more the aerobics. Okay, I do the other things too. And I really had a hard time when I started teaching co-ed because I didn't change. I decided I enjoyed that and it was a valuable thing. And I found that the boys were stronger in the strength, but they did have difficulty in flexibility. Girls had some trouble in endurance, and I felt the aerobics was good for that. They caught on coordination-wise a little better than the guys did. And I had a real hard time getting through and still that's not a girl's exercise routine. Mm-hmm. That's not a boy's exercise routine. The men I work with, I have to kind of force and push them sometimes. because they are also have been pushed to, one's been through the military, and he definitely feels that that's the form of fitness. It has, in a way, though, kind of lost some activities like modern dance. Now, maybe there's some boys who would like to get into modern or interpretive dance, but because of that type of activity, they also are inhibited, because if they got in there, it probably called you laughed out of the class. But Title IX says we have to have 50% boys in the class and 50% girls. So it's restricted also some of the things that we could teach that maybe just
that
all didn't work
through with time.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. But that was a frustration all of a sudden that I kind of felt, I kind of fought Title IX because of that. Because I still think there's some value in some all-girls activities and some all-boys activities. I don't think it proves one or the other being weaker. I just think there's some things that I don't enjoy, my husband doesn't enjoy. And yet I feel equal.
Oh yeah, I think there, I mean, I would agree that sometimes it's nice to have women's teams and men's teams and all that, because in certain, I think the sexes are better in some things than in others. I think balancing beam is women would do better on it than a lot of men.
But
I
boys
think
need to be exposed to it.
That's
and
right,
some of the
yeah.
boys in gymnastics were just thrilled that
they got to do that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Man, this is really neat. I've never been in this class before, so it has had advantages too. Mm-hmm. Good tumblers. Some of the smaller guys especially really excelled. They didn't want to be football players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, tumbling is always, or gymnastics has always been a sport for the smaller, more compact person, I think, for
yeah.
both men and women, rather than height, which would be an advantage in basketball.
I would think it's interesting that through all these myths that the women were, you know, were not intelligent, but yet they were the ones that were supposed to raise the children who were
yeah.
going to be the intelligent ones.
That's
yeah.
what I know was fun.
Yeah, you know, we were given all this responsibility, and once I thought, and I sat and looked at my four children, I thought, the responsibility I have as the mother, you know, and the fathers do too, of course, a lot of responsibility, but there for a while it was just the woman home with the kids.
Well, that's where you get this kind of this funny juxtaposition of women are good at some things
yeah.
and not
yeah.
good at others.
Yeah. Couldn't take care of themselves. That's a myth itself.
I've noticed that the MMPI scale for male-femaleness, you know, if a woman scores real high on that, which measures aggression or assertiveness mostly, she's considered real sick, and that goes through until still today. And if the man scores low and is considered feminine, then he's sick.
Well, the people, I'm not sure they really interpret that as sick and health anymore, but it is interesting on the MMPI. The higher the man's educational level, the more feminine he's apt to measure. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of my professors is very interested in opera, teaches religion, and I said, if you took the MMPI, you'd score very high on the feminine scale, and he said, I took it and I did. Which shows you how these culturally conditioned things are.